Accession number 33891.
Reel 8.
So, you moved on to Malta.
Malta Comm Flight. Flying officer and CO. Again, no training. I hadn't a clue about what was supposed to be going on. And found that what our task was there. Incidentally, I was towed nearby a Lancaster from Malta. Had come to collect me. The Lancaster was part of the SE Rescue Service based on Malta. And that was my one and only trip in the Lancaster. But our job was actually, under the direction of the senior air staff officer, fly passengers, do a communication, shall we say, with any of the stations under the control of Malta headquarters. And that was Sicily, Sardinia, Castelbenito, that's directly opposite, directly south of Malta, and
that's
Tunisia, yeah. And anywhere else that anybody of the VIPs need to be taken. And there was the most annoying part of them. We had a Dakota, which I was not allowed to fly, because the pilot there was a VIP pilot attached to Comm Flight. He was a flight lieutenant, incidentally he was with a DSO, but he was really based in the UK, and he was the VIP pilot, show you. Although I flew the Commander-in-Chief around and others around occasionally, and our job was to fly them. It was just myself and a warrant officer, two pilots, that's all there was. And the aircraft were Wellingtons, and the Wellingtons have been converted to passenger flying. Again, pity we can't show photographs, but I've taken a photograph of the interior, and the Bombay was converted to carrying oil items of freight and things like that. And we just flew around generally anywhere instructed. Sardinia, Sicily, as I say, Catania at Sicily, and it was doing, shall we say, being the taxi service for Malta. The only thing here that's a little interesting, well, there are a number of interesting aspects. On my previous job in Bari, on one occasion I picked up a whole host of people, and one of them was a lady all on her own. And I said to the co-pilot, look, can't leave her down there all the time. You go back and have a chat with the chap and ask her if she can. And she came and sat in the right-hand seat. And she told me her name, it was Mabel Strickland. And I said, oh, didn't have a clue of who she was, and we were chatting generally. And I said, how's it in Malta? She said, oh, she said, we're getting there, she said, but I still miss some things. I said, for example, I miss bananas. I haven't had a banana for years. And Turkish delight, I haven't. So I said, oh, well, look, I'll tell you what, I'm going on to Cairo, and I'll be back this way in a few days' time. If I get them for you, can arrange for them to be picked up. So, yes, lovely. So when I got back to Malta, and I taxied in, then I was told, there's a chauffeur in his Rolls Royce waiting to meet you. So I said, oh? The chauffeur said, you've got something from the Honourable Mabel Strickland. So I said, yes, that's right. He said, well, I'll take it for you. She's terribly sorry. Can't come and collect it. How much does she owe you? I said, no, this is a present, thank you very much. And off he went. Well, the Honourable Mabel Strickland was the daughter of Lord Strickland, who'd been governor. She was now a VIP on the island, and ran the paper called The Times of Malta. That was first. And built the first tourist hotel later on in Malta. So now I was posted to Malta. And was introduced to the various officers' messes, and two officers' clubs in Malta. And I was in one of them on my own, on my way drinking away, and somebody stood in front of me and said, what are you doing here? And I looked up, and it was Mabel Strickland. So I said, well, I'm posted here now. Are you? And why are you on your own? I said, well, I know you'll come and join my party. And she had a niece there whose father was a commodore on one of the aircraft carriers. And I discovered soon later that she was partly engaged to a fleet air arm pilot who was always at sea, and she became my dancing partner because you couldn't go up to a dance in Malta. Maltese girls wouldn't go without an escort. And we had a nice time together, but the Honourable Mabel Strickland made my life a wee bit uncomfortable from time to time. There was one occasion, for example, on the Sunday Times of Malta, on the back page, was Heard in the Hive by the Bee. And Mabel Strickland had organised a cocktail party to which all the VIPs of the island, group kept the senior officers, who didn't. And right at the bottom, also present, was flying off the A Garrett, flying off the A Garrett and Miss Margaret Buckley, right at the bottom. I went into breakfast on that Sunday morning, and as I went in, everybody stood up to attention. And then I was shown this article in the newspaper. So I asked them not to do that again because it was a bit embarrassing. But we had a good time. Anyway, that was the job, flying around.
Where were you based in the world?
Lucca. I went there a few years ago and quite changed the airfield. But here I had my second argument with a senior officer. And this time it was an Air Commodore, a senior air staff officer, who was my controller. Odd arrangement in that Senior Flying Officer, Wing Commander Flying, really had no control on me. He has to keep an eye on me, but I did what the Sasso instructed. And the story goes so, I was taking a Wellington up on an air test, and one engine failed, the starboard engine began to rough run, and so I shut it down and flew around the island. Now on the Wellington, that engine, the starboard engine, is also the power for the hydraulics. So to get the undercarriage down, I had to pump it down, and I was on my own. So I'm flying on one engine, pumping away as I fly around the island. If you can picture Malta, you go round the island, you get to the entrance to the Grand Harbour, and you go straight down the Grand Harbour, the runway for Lucas at the end. When I got to the end, I still hadn't got my wheels locked down. I'd already told control I was in trouble, and that I had no hydraulic power. And when I got to that point, I said, I haven't locked my wheels down yet, am I clear to do a 360 degree turn until I go on pumping? Until I get it down, affirmative, no other traffic used, so I flew around, finished. Now I was in line with the runway, with no power on the hydraulics. I couldn't get my flaps down, and I didn't have any brakes. There was no way I could concentrate on landing and try and bump. So I decided to do something called a flapless landing, which means you're coming a bit higher and a wee bit faster. The flaps, when they're down, give you a lower stalling speed. So when you're up, you would stall higher, but it's right. So I came in. Now, when you land on Lucca, right at the beginning of the runway is a road runs past, and the controller switches the traffic lights to stop traffic. And I noticed, quickly on, whole line of traffic waiting. So it's touchdown. Now, when you're on one engine, and there's any pull on the engine, and you can't have any brakes, you could start turning, because the engine will turn you. You will get some effect from the rudder, but not much, because the engine is more... So the moment I ducked down, I switched off the other engine, came to a stop about two-thirds up the runway. And no brakes, it just ran out of steam. So I sat there waiting for a track to come pushed on, and I was towed back into the dispersal. As I went into my office, I heard the phone ringing, and I heard the warrant officer on the phone, and he said, "Yes, sir, he's just coming into the office, sir." So I went into the office and picked up the phone. He said, "It's the Sasso." So I said, "Yes, sir, may I help you?" And he said, "What the bloody hell do you think you're doing, man?" So I said, "I'm sorry, sir, what do you mean?" He said, "Don't try it on me." He said, "The command catering officer was sitting at the traffic lights, and he saw you. He said you came in so high, so fast, that you had to switch off both engines, stop going off the end of the runway." So I said, "Sir, you tell the command catering officer, he can fly any better than me, but come and do the bloody thing," and I hung up. And I knew something was going to happen. So I waited, the phone rang. Station Edge, yeah. Yeah. Gary, the CO wants to see you. I said, I'm not surprised. So I arrived at CO and said, what do you think you've been doing in your beach? So I explained the situation to him. And he said, oh my God. So I picked up the phone, gone to Sato and explained it to him. I know. He said, right, leave it with me, I'll sort this out. 3 days later, I got a letter from the command catering officer, I apologised.
So did he just think you were mucking about?
No, he just thought I'd come in too fast, too high, because he was a penguin. He just realised I was higher and over than usual, faster than usual, and switched off, because he couldn't see the right-hand engine already stopped. He only saw one engine running, so he thought I'd stop both engines upon landing. I went dashing straight to the Sasso to tell about it. Now, the command catering officer bloody fool to do this because one of the things that they were short of on the island was chickens. And when I used to go over to Castel Bonito, I would always bring back boxes of chicken eggs, primarily for the messes, and also for a couple of families that I made friends with, the daughter family, this good young lady, and another family who I'd flown back from Morocco one way back, where it happened to be, a doctor and his family. And on the next trip I did, I came back with these eggs, and 2 days later I had a phone call, so-and-so, the command catering office wondering when he's going to get his next load of eggs. So I'm terribly sorry, the last lot I got for him, I dropped them, they've all broken and hung up. He got them the next time. It wasn't fair to deprive the officer's mess of eggs because of that.
Did you have any other
just the Dakota? Just the Dakota and the Wellington. But because of that particular trip, I complained bitterly to the Sasso about the state of the aircraft. I think we had two or three. One of them had been obviously out in the desert, and the skin was peeling back in places. It had the reattachment, and I said that in my opinion, the aircraft were not really safe for passenger flying, especially as some of the passengers were senior officers. And he had a few attacks, got onto a tech gloves, and anyway, as a result, all the Wellingtons were taken away. We were supplied with Anson Mark 12s, which were designed and built for passenger carrying.
So how did they differ from the Ansons
that you... Only that they were superior inside and more up to date with the equipment, and we didn't have a signaller. All our navigating was done pilot navigation, even to El Adam and back. Of course, a very plush sort of seating in the back of the aircraft. And I think, as I recall, it didn't have a toilet.
How many people could you carry?
Eight, as I recall. Yes, eight. And we carried on flying Ansons around. I can't think of any more interesting stories about Malta. Not the ones that make you laugh. Although there were a few, I suppose, but... No, it was an interesting job, and of course, while I was there, that the Berlin Air had started, just as I was coming to the end of my 2.5 year plus tour in the Middle East.
So I'm taking it in that
time,
you were able to
get
that
in the Yeah.
Okay, please take me through that story.
Well, we'd gone to El Adam, dropping off the passengers, and we were told this was now. March 48, that an aircraft taking off from Benina to fly to Tunis had disappeared over the water, and would we have a search for it on the way? So we went through to Benina, topped up with fuel to give us an extra, and it was bloody awful flying weather. And we did a sort of zigzag along trying to find crap, but we didn't find it. And then when we got back to Malta, we had a rather hectic time trying to land because the pretty strong crosswind, But that was really the only major exciting thing. But I left Malta, oh, as usual, on July the 23rd, 1948.
Can I ask, obviously, you mentioned poor flying weather on that search.
Very strong winds.
What was generally the weather conditions like in the Mediterranean?
They're pretty good. Well, I mean, the Mediterranean is home for all the UK's tourists, isn't it? And the weather was pretty good, but in the when the wind really got up and picked up the sand from the desert, I mean, we were often grounded in Malta because of the sand blowing off the desert. Later on, years same when we were in Cyprus. But when I left Malta, I got 2,900 hours in the logbook. So I was building it up.
Where were you posted to and from Malta?
I was posted from Malta to Abingdon, near Oxfordshire. Eventually. Initially, I was posted to Hendon to fly on the Air Ministry Communications flight. This is while I was waiting for a posting or some whatever's going to come up. I had been told it was just a fill-in. So there was I doing on a comm flight, or comm squadron, run by a wing commander, having left one where I'd been in command of a flying officer, but this was the Air Ministry's. And I stayed there for a couple of months.
Was that similar work then?
Yes, but it was single engine aircraft, just flying the odd passenger. In fact, yeah. This was it, posted to Hot Hendon. On the comms squadron, and the sort of thing we did was flying air cadets round, taking off passengers. Again, with only one passenger, because that's what you could have room for. Cosford, Marham, Oakington, places like that.
So people, what would the flights involve in? Would you just
taking senior officers or inspecting officers, or, you know, some peculiar visit required at the station, and just flying them up there?
And you said it was a prop.
A Proctor aircraft.
Can you tell me about the Proctor?
Proctor. Twin engine, a single engine aircraft, who's really designed for training aircraft. In most of the schools in those days, I believe, the elementary flying was done on a Proctor. And it's very similar to the Chipmunk, one of the single engine. I don't remember too much about it, and I didn't stay there long. I left having flown about 30 hours on it before I was posted to Dishforth.
Were they a reliable aircraft?
Oh, very, well, they're very reliable. I don't think the Ministry of Defence would have used it for their comm squadron if they hadn't. But I only did a few months there. The only amusing part about that I can recall, I was there during Battle of Britain Day, and we were all asked to stand by aircraft, you know, when it was open to the public, and Joe was standing by a Spitfire that he'd never seen before. So I had an opportunity to look into a Spitfire for the one and only time in my life. And of course, it got on well with the girls, because I was standing there as the young flying officer, and girls seemed to think I was the pilot. I don't know what got them that impression. And there I went up to Dishforth to learn how to fly Yorks.
Well, if you could take that through a little bit. So if we can work on that.
Right.
So you were posted up to Dishforth.
Yep, I was posted to Dishforth to start learning how to fly the darn thing. And had a brand new crew, of course, first people I'd never met before, including my co-pilot, who was an army sergeant from the glider. We were running short of pilots. I had pilot, he as a co-pilot, navigator and a signaller, and a flight engineer. Nowadays, of course, it's two pilots and a lot of computers. I'd never flown four-engined aircraft before, so it was new techniques to learn. And the usual thing of switching off engines while you were doing your training, doing instrument flying. And by then, they'd introduced an instrument rating test, which was quite complicated and very difficult to describe. But primarily it was a case of starting from a point, climbing up, doing a turn, which finished up 90 degrees to your initial pilot, descending, and then another turn, turning away 90 degrees, another turn, all under the instrument, flying back to where you started from, doing descending, climbing, turns, all under the hood. That was all part. The other thing they did as part of that test while you were under the hood is for the instructor to take the aircraft over. And he would throw it all over the place as much as he could, left and right, up and down, and then say, "You've got it," and you had to recover, get it into the right position. All part of the instrument flying. And of course you took off on instruments. You could just see the runway in front, you got in line, you took off and took off on instruments. And you did the landing by ground controlled approach, which is where GCA, which is where a chap is sitting in a caravan alongside the runway, but safe enough onto the side. He's got two radar screens. One has a line, which both have lines, indicating the flight, the glider path that flight aircraft should take from the 1,000 feet position 10 miles out to the touchdown. One would show the aircraft above or below the glide path, the other would show the path to the left or the right of the glide path. And here you would take instructions from the chap on the ground. You didn't answer, you didn't reply to him, you did exactly what you were told, because there was no time wasted to acknowledge you, because you could have moved another couple of degrees off. And he talked you down all the way until you got to the point, look in hand and see it land. And that look ahead and land was based on the fact you'd got to about 200 feet and therefore you'd come out of the cloud. And this was done a great deal later on, and well, it's all been many aircraft using that system. To me, one of the best ways of landing an aircraft in bad flying conditions.
Well, most of the ground controllers then were they pilots or ex-pilots?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not really sure. I would have. Well, certainly they were obviously trained for the job, and possibly were pilots or ground. Most likely, though, more likely they were air traffic controllers who've been trained for it. But that's something I don't know. Maybe something you would like to find out and let me know.
When you said you did the instruments training under the hood, was it a hood that you would actually wear in
it? Yeah, you'd put it. You put it over your helmet, or in this case, you had a hearing phone, in such a way that you could only see directly in front of you. You could only see your instrument, and if you were try to look up, so you could look over the top. You've got a thumb on the top of the head. So you just looked at the instrument, and that's all you could see, the instrument, including, of course, the engine instrument, which I had to keep an eye on, too. Although the co-pilot, under normal circumstances, were you doing more of that. And you just stuck to it and flew the aircraft.
And I take it with a lot of the work that you were doing on instruments was because of the nature of what you were going to be doing, wasn't
it? Not necessarily, because I think the course was designed way before the airlift started. It was because you might fly in cloud conditions anywhere in the world. If you were going to go onto York, you were going into transport command, and you could be flying anywhere around, taking people to the Far East, to Africa, or anything like that. So you had to know the conditions you could fly out could vary, and you needed to know how to fly on your instrument properly.
You mentioned, though, as well, that going to a four-engine aircraft,
oh, well, of course, there were different techniques in that. The essential point with a twin engine, if your engines were running slightly different speeds, you'd hear it. With a four engine, it's very, you know, wanted to get them lined up so there's no noise, and you want to make sure all four engines are doing exactly the same. But again, the co-pilot would be watching that rather more than you did. But the technique was only different in that you had to four throttles to operate. When you're doing takeoff and landing, you know, you've got a good wide grip to do that. But otherwise, there's no major difference in flying the aircraft. The techniques for everything, turning, descending, instrument ratings, all the same. Just that you've got more power and more weight behind you.
And what's the role of the flight engineer?
Well, when I say the co-pilot, the flight engineer would be in complete control. He would be watching temperatures, pressures, all those sort of things that don't show up on the front. The same sort of thing you have more in the car, the thing that could go wrong. And he would basically really be the engine controller and tell you that everything was wrong. And he'd be watching the fuel rather more than you did.
So that's quite, I assume that's quite a useful thing for the pilot to have.
Yeah, that extra, you know, sort of. You're beginning to worry me. Did I have a flight engineer on York? Yes, of course I did. Yes, yes, of course I did. Oops, better not put it up there, have I?
So he would basically be, in a sense, he's watching the engine, so that frees you up.
Well,
in a sense,
I think you create a simile here. You would have up on the bridge of a ship the captain and the navigator, and down way below would be the engineer watching the engines. It's pretty much the same. He's in charge and will tell you if things are not as they should be. Mind you, he got a bit fed up when the flying instructor shut down engines without warning him, and you know, he suddenly says, and then he would be the one that shout, "You've lost power on so and so engine," and you take the action accordingly, feather and what have you.
So all your training would be done with a full complement of crew, would it, in a full engine?
Yeah, well, your co-pilot would know, but may not fly with you, because he would be out of the be in the way. But the interesting thing too, though, is that there was one of the QFIs, flying instructors, who was a cunning little so-and-so, in that while you were under the hood, he would slowly throttle back an engine, very, very slowly, until he'd got it off, and watched to see how long it took you to react to you having to keep trim the aircraft to keep it going. You just watched that. It was a good test. It was a good test.
And it was something that obviously is a very useful.
Oh yes, I mean, anything like that, if you can train for it. I mean, we read recently, didn't we, of the pilot in Thailand who lost an engine on takeoff, panicked and throttled, but shut down the other engine. I suspect perhaps they are not being quite as well trained as, mind you, it did happen on the Dakota when we first started with that chap, so it can happen. But it's a thing you try to avoid.